I sometimes come here?
Whenever you like. It's your home, too. There are people here who love you.
I look at you and Tina, share with you peace and contentment.
Of course. And just think it won't be for this time only. That is, if you will help me keep what we have. If we both try hard to protect that little strip of territory that's ours. We can talk about your child.
Our child.
Thank you.
And will you be happy, Charlotte?
Oh, Jerry, don't let us ask for the moon. We have the stars.
Everybody, and welcome to True Stories from Tinseltown, and I have got a treat for you guys today. I have Monica Henried on our show, and she is the daughter of Paul Henried. Hello, Monica. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
Oh, yeah. We were supposed to do this earlier, but there was drilling in New York City, and I tell you, it just reverberates everywhere. But Monica was sweet enough to do it today, and it's nice and quiet and rainy, so amen.
Rain.
Yes. I love the rain.
Okay.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the documentary you're doing on your dad, because I found the more I read about him, I just didn't know all these things. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. He had quite a remarkable life and quite a remarkable career. But to tell you the truth, I really think his life was more interesting and more exceptional than any roles that he played, which is kind of stunning, if you think about it.
It is, because a lot of people say they have boring lives. I just go to the studio, and I'm there all day and night, and whatever they do. But that's something big to say, because I don't think most people could say that. Most actors and actresses now are in the days of golden age of Hollywood. So you're generally making the documentary to kind of show who your dad, to not kind of, to show who your dad is. And his fans will learn so much about him. Like I said, I didn't know half of these things. Fascinating.
He really had an amazing life. And it's funny because I always say he was always in the right place at the right time and in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So
he had these huge, you know, highs and lows in his life. And that's tough on a guy.
But he stood. He withstood it, and he was strong.
Yeah. And I must give a lot of credit to my mother for that. They were together for 60 years.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. Liesl, right?
Liesl, yes, another great story. But what was interesting to me as I was, you know, looking back, because obviously I didn't get to know them when they were young and met in Vienna and started their lives together and so on and so forth. So in sort of researching it out and talking to cousins and people who were around, it was, it only validated what I knew of her once I was part of the family too, if you know what I mean. You know,
yeah.
And we don't interrogate or question our parents about what their lives were like necessarily. You know, we're all involved in our own lives, going to school and surviving being a teenager,
right?
And all that kind of
stuff. Yes.
And then grown-ups, and we don't go backward. It's not that we don't honor them. It's just, you know, it's time. We just don't have the time to do everything, you know.
And it's so disappointing, though, too, you know, because I just want to say my dad died when I was 16, and I found out all this stuff after he died, that he was an entertainer, that he, you know, I knew none of this. I knew he was an accountant. I didn't know anything else about him. So you knew parts of your dad.
An accountant and an entertainer.
Yeah, he was both sides of the brain. Both sides.
That's amazing.
It is.
Amazing. Yeah.
So tell us about your dad's upbringing. Was his dad a baron? I read that somewhere, or is that just a myth?
It would be more fair to say that it would be the equivalent of, say, being knighted.
Mm.
He wasn't born into aristocracy, but he was given a title because of things that he did as a banker, because he was involved with the Kaiser Franz Josef and the bank that was involved with the Kaiser. So they knew each other. He went to lunch with the Kaiser.
Hung with the Kaiser, yeah.
with the Kaiser. So he had given the Kaiser some good advice, I guess, let's put it that way, and so did get sort of a knighthood type of thing. He wasn't a baron. And that, you know, honestly, that's part of why I want to do the documentary. I'd like to tell my father's story correctly, once, from beginning to end, but with clarifying the myth and mythology that goes along with his life and career. Because you can look him up, you'll find people talking about him, people on Facebook, people on all social media, and in Wikipedia and IMDb, and you get all of these snippets and different pieces of his life. And I must say, even in his book, it's not 100%. It's just bits and pieces. And so I just would like to tell the story once correctly from beginning to end, and then go from there.
And you're the person to do it. Who could do it better?
Listen, I've been, you know, I don't want to say fighting this, but I have been fighting this all my life, because the first question I get from people when I do film festivals or go out and do Q&As for my father's films or introduce my father's films, whatever, the first question is always, what was it like being the daughter of Paul Henry? What was it like growing up in Hollywood? And I think to myself, you know, as a joke, I said to somebody one day, you know what, I'm going to make a documentary about this whole thing, and I'm for $24.95, you'll know everything there is to know. So it kind of started out of humor, but I realized at some point it's the best way to do it. Just tell the story once and then let everybody have all the information. Then there it is, you know?
Because like I said, you know, I read he's a baron. I read all these different things, and you're here to clear that up, because now I know I'm wrong. You know, well, whoever wrote it was wrong. I don't know who wrote it. But so your dad was born in Trieste, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And he had his mom and dad. And tragically, his father died when your dad was 9.
Yes, correct. He also had a younger brother.
Oh.
So he did have a brother. Yes.
And so that must have been horrible for him to lose his dad at that age. At any age, it hurts, no matter even if you're older. But when you're a kid, it's so confusing and weird, and you don't really understand the concept.
It completely changed his life and the lifestyle that they were accustomed to living, and it literally changed everything, everything.
Financially, obviously, emotionally, all that stuff.
Well, back in those days, you know, certainly in the middle 19 teens, no woman was possibly capable of, you know, keeping a checkbook balanced or her family affairs in order.
Right.
So the uncles took over, and there were some that were, how do you talk about family? There were some who were nicer than others.
Yes.
There were a few who were quite controlling, and one of the controlling ones, it literally was the one who took over, and so they had to move from where they were living. They were no longer living in the lifestyle they were accustomed to. They switched schools. My grandmother and the two boys moved out of Vienna to get close to her parents to feel more sense of connection again. And
yeah,
when he went to school, you know, in a little tiny town. And
Where did they move to? Where was your mom's mom? Your grandma.
Grandmother's family.
Yes.
Lived at least part-time in, or just on the outskirts of a town called Krems, which is on the Danube. But it's about, I mean, even now today, a train ride is about an hour. So it was quite a ways out of Vienna.
Yeah. And it must have been hard for him, because he had to give up all his school pals and everything he had known. And but at least he had his grandma there, too. You know, so I'm sure she loved him and helped with that. So he basically...
To be honest with you, I don't know, because I never, ever heard him talk about it.
That's something. You know, parents didn't. They didn't talk about that. I think the younger parents now, maybe they do. But I don't think, just like when we were teens, we don't, like, I don't want to hear it when I'm a teenager. When anyone's a teenager, they're like, oh, be quiet, mom and dad, you know, leave me alone. I don't care, you know, and that whole thing happened. So that's funny. He never told you. But
yeah,
he met your mom in that town or at school
in Vienna. Ultimately, the family did move back to Vienna. He and his brother and mother moved back to Vienna, and he got into the very, very elite school, the Theresianum, which was just the best of the best. And it was, again, mostly because of the position that his father had held.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he was deceased, still because it was the bloodline, he was allowed to go to this school. And that school, an all-boys school at that time, would have parties and dances with the all-girls school. So my parents actually met when they were probably in their teens without becoming friends or getting to know each other particularly well. And then once my father had established or was beginning to establish his career as an actor in the theater, there was an after opening night party and that he attended with a blind date. He didn't even want to go, but he was going along as an extra guy to be with a friend's, you know, the girlfriend, the extra date kind of a
the third wheel.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he saw my mother across the room and they ended up chatting, and then they realized they had met before, and she was there with a date she didn't particularly care for. And then he decided that he had to leave, and she said, well, I'll take you and your date, you know, I'll drop you off at home. And my mother, being brilliant always and forever, dropped off her date, dropped off his date, and drove to the top of the Kobenzl, which is a beautiful, magnificent hillside above Vienna. And they danced and they drank champagne and they talked and never realized that the sun was coming up. And from that day forward, we're never separated.
How romantic. You said that this story was much more romantic than any of the romantic roles he did. And that happened. And they stayed married 60 years. That is so amazing.
We were together 60 years. It
amazing.
Is amazing. Well, he really hit the jackpot, because his own family, his mother and his uncles, didn't understand him at all. I mean, their opinion of an actor was, you know, we've never had one in the family and we're not going to start now.
Didn't someone laugh in his face or something when he said he wanted to be an actor, one of the family members?
No. This family was much too serious. They would never
laugh. No.
That isn't who they are at all, which is why my mother was such a blessing, because her family was all artists and poets and writers. Her father was the director of the Kunsthistorische Museum in Vienna for 30 years. So it was all about art and the arts and performance and music and dance and so on and so forth. So when he wanted to pursue his career, he now had this new family around him that was completely supportive, where his own had never. Yeah, really, really, really lucky.
That he was. And, you know, when you don't have that kind of thing and you have the serious family, it must be like this big hallelujah that you meet this wonderful woman, you fall in love, and she has this fabulous family that loves you, that are fun, and that understands you. He hit the double jackpot there.
Absolute jackpot. Yep.
So he then was on the stage, right, with Max Reinhardt? He was his protege?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say protege, but he was part of the original, I shouldn't say even original, but he was part of the, Reinhardt had a theater company and a sort of an academy for actors,
mm-hmm.
and father had auditioned for him and did get into that group, yes. Yes.
Was Hedy Lamarr in that one, too?
No, not
that one?
Not that one.
Oh,
no.
So he got into that. And then didn't they want him? He got into film, and they always wanted, or was that in England, that they wanted him to always play a Nazi?
No, he got into film because he spent some time in the south of France and was seen by some producers and got into these bit parts because he was tall and good looking and they kind of liked that.
Very. I didn't know he was so tall. 6'3".
Okay. 6'3", yeah. And then back in Vienna when he was doing theater, again, he's very photogenic. And they discovered that luckily at an early age with him, and he was in his mid-20s, and he got small parts in some Austrian films. Yes. Yes, he did. That's, I mean, everything started for him in Vienna. His career, the love of his life, his passion for everything, food, cars, everything, it all started in Vienna.
And then he, was that the first, where did he get his first blacklist from?
Well, he, because he was doing well in movies in Austria, a scout from Ufa had seen him and offered to have him come to Berlin to look at the studio and meet the people and so on and so forth. And of course, by then it was pretty much becoming a propaganda machine. Yeah. And Goebbels was there and so on. So I think he was very interested in the contract. It would have been great for his career. But in order to do that, you had to be a member of the National Socialist German Actors Guild, and that wouldn't be something he would ever sign. So what they then did was just said, no, you're not working in any German language film, period. Period, meaning Austria or Germany or wherever. So that was really the first time he was blacklisted.
And so then he moved. Conrad Veidt had something to do with it, or Veidt. I love him. What a wonderful actor.
Yeah, but yes, but no. Yes, but no. He obviously, after this little Berlin experience, he went back to Vienna. He continued in theater because he felt that even if the Nazis could touch film, which they were certainly trying to turn into propaganda for themselves, they wouldn't be able to touch the theater. So he thought he was safe in the theater. And then he got an offer to go to England to do a play, which he did and he enjoyed, and then went back to Vienna and did some more theater, and then was invited back to England again to do another couple of plays. And so he became comfortable with going to England and coming back. And by 1938, it was obvious that they all had to get out of Vienna. So he accepted a job in London, and that really was the kickoff to his career.
So he and your mom went to London.
He went first. My mother had shops. She was a couturier designer and costume designer. And he went first and sort of established a household. And then she came, and ultimately they brought her parents over and the staff and so on and so forth. And that was working well until England got more involved in the war. And then he became classified as an enemy alien first class.
How weird.
Well, he's an Austrian, and after the English by extension, and a German, and then ultimately perceived to be, well, if you're a German and you're a Nazi. And so he was, you know, first blacklisted because he wasn't a Nazi, and the second time he was blacklisted because they assumed he was a Nazi. And my parents were going to be separated, either deported or sent to detention camps, and by incredible luck and goodwill and so on and so forth, that didn't happen. And that's what brought him to the United States. And that's more or less where Connie got involved, because he had already established himself as an actor in London. And my father and the Veidts were friends.
He was great. He played that horrible Nazi to a T. He was such a good actor.
He was sensational. Underrated. I mean, I wish there was a whole flurry, a big festival just for his films, because his performances range so far and so deep. He was a wonderful, wonderful actor.
Wasn't he in the cabinet of Dr.
Caligari? Yeah.
Yes, that's what I thought. He was so good in that. And he was just a kid. He was actually very handsome, I thought.
There's photographs of him when he was young that are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm sure he was a hunk and a half. So your dad got to Hollywood.
Yes.
He set himself up. Your mom was with him this time because she couldn't stay in England, right? They all had to kind of leave at the same time.
Yes, correct.
And how did he get into the movie studios in Hollywood?
Well, again, through the theater. He was doing a play on Broadway, and wonderfully ironic. Well, again, here is a perfect example of him being in the right place at the right time. When he was appearing in the play on Broadway, a film he had made in London the previous year called Night Train to Munich happened to also open about a block and a half away. So his name was on two marquees simultaneously.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
From unknown person to person with his name on two marquees on Broadway.
That's amazing.
Stunning. Yeah, pretty stunning. So he became very visible. And again, it was a scout or a producer from RKO saw him and brought him, helped him come to Hollywood.
And he was tall and handsome and photogenic. And I'm trying to look at what his first part in Hollywood was.
Joan of Paris.
I love that movie. He was a freedom fighter, right?
He was.
He was great in that. I really like that movie. Made me cry. Yeah. The ending made me cry. And then this is the one I know and love your father from the most. Now Voyager. Other people say Casablanca, but I loved Jerry and Camille Beauchamp. I love
you're not
so
alone. By the way, you're not alone.
I just love that movie. And they were so great together.
And
I have to ask you this, because this is also the big thing, the big old two cigarette thing. So do you know how many people have taken credit for that? I think the director took credit for, I know your father said he did it on his own, which I believe that's the true story. But the director, I think Betty, the cameraman, I don't know, so many people took credit for that. But it was fabulous.
Yeah. Here we go again, because this is all the myth and mythology. Mm-hmm. Long after the fact, after Now Voyager existed, I would watch my parents do exactly that motion, because that's something that came from them. It came from him. I mean, my father loved, I mentioned it a little bit, but he loved cars, so the opportunity to take a road trip in my mother's car was like the greatest thing in the world in 1933, 1934. So they would cruise, they would take a day trip out of Vienna just to go down the river or go to the Lake Country or something like that. And all of those cars, of course, were all standard transmissions. So if whoever was driving wanted a cigarette, the person in the navigator seat would light two simultaneously and pass one over to the driver. It didn't matter if my mother was driving or if my father was driving. It was just something that was in their habit. That's what they did. That's how they took care of each other. They loved each other and so on. So when my father came home that day, let me go backward again a minute. In the book, in the Prouty book, Now Voyager, she does describe this action of sharing cigarettes, lighting two cigarettes, not the way they ended up doing it, but sharing two cigarettes. Mm-hmm. That's how it was translated into the script, into the original script. So it reads fine. It reads charming. It reads wonderfully. But when it came down to actually physically going through all the motions as written, it was awkward. It was all arms and cigarettes and hands in the face. And I mean, it just didn't work.
It wasn't romantic.
It just didn't work.
Right.
There are certain physical pieces of business that you use in theater or in film that work very well that don't work in real life and vice versa.
Yeah.
So my father, after this sort of frustrating day, mentioned to my mother that night, this is such an awkward piece of business. And my mother literally said, well, why don't you just do what we do? He went on the set in the morning. He explained it to Betty. He did it for Betty. She loved it. They took it to Irving Rapper, who was the director. He hated it, absolutely hated it. Betty, in her glory and wisdom, went over his head and called Hal Wallace, who was the producer on the film. Hal Wallace came and saw it, thought it was genius and brilliant and beautiful the way they handled it. And loved it so much that he actually had the writer, Casey Robinson, put that piece of business into the film a few more times.
Yeah, that was...
It was only in the script once originally.
It worked. it's so funny. They look at each other. They smoke. The last part is the one that makes me laugh, kind of. Shall we just have a smoke on it? And then he does his business. They both take it in, and then they blow smoke in each other's face while they're looking at each other. So beautiful. Oh, It's so beautiful, so cute. And I don't know how they don't cough. I'm amazed. Why aren't they coughing? But it is.
They were both smokers is why.
Oh, my goodness. Betty's never without. Whenever I do a lot of pictures on my website and on my Facebook page, and she is never without a cigarette. She's in the bathtub. She's got a cigarette.
Yeah. So I remember it well.
And so then after he made Now Voyager, and I love that movie, and he made a couple with Betty, but we'll get back into that, and also with Claude Rains, he was supposed to shoot Casablanca right away, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good, I'm correct on that one.
Yes, completely correct.
Okay, so at first he wasn't too crazy about doing Casablanca. Is that correct?
No.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And of course, ironically, it turned out that he was right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
History has proved him wrong, but at the time, it was it did not work in his favor, and he knew it wouldn't. So that's why he hesitated. But he did get his agent to negotiate a better deal. In the original play, you don't really see Victor Laszlo. There's a lot of conversation about him, but you don't meet him. And in the film, I think in the original few pages that were written, that was implied also. And my father said, first of all, it's going to hurt my career to play the second man in this film. And if you want me in it, you have to bolster the part. You have to make it make sense, that you have to understand his relationship with her relationship with him, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, and he asked that to please have his name, above the title, which was indeed in his original contract.
So he did get it. And it was Bogart, Ingrid,
pardon me?
And him. It was Bogart, Ingrid, and your dad above the title, or just Bogart and your dad? Well, it had to be Ingrid as well.
It was the three of them. But he knew instinctively that that was going to hurt his career, and it did. So, but, and then that leads to other things. Like, ultimately, he became a writer and a director and a producer, and he learned how to put films together on his own, and he learned to fight for getting things done. And, if he had just stayed with being a leading man, per se, in these lovely films, I think he maybe wouldn't have had the opportunity to play some of the other characters that he really enjoyed playing and wanted to play. I mean, he went head to head with Jack. I can't tell you how many times he was suspended at Warner Brothers because he would go head to head with Jack about the implication, these fluffy leading men who really weren't terribly interesting. They didn't. Now, I'm not talking about either Victor Laszlo or Jerry Durant. I'm talking about what came after. And he wanted to be a swashbuckler. He wanted to be the villain. He wanted to do all of these things. And Jack Warner absolutely said, no,
you have to be the dreamboat.
You have to be the leading man.
He did another with Betty. He did Devotion.
Devotion was with Ida Lupino.
Deception with Betty. And I love that movie, too.
Yes, I do, too.
I think it's fabulous. I think Betty's great. They had she and he had a nice rapport. And with Claude Rains,
that film belongs to Claude Rains.
Oh, he owned it.
He chewed the scenery like nobody else's business. I mean, he was absolutely, and I mean that in a good way. I know some people think that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. But the three of them, the three of them playing off of each other and knowing each other's character and dynamics and so on and so forth. I mean, the three of them were just sensational together.
They were. I love that. I think I know you're friends with Jessica Rains, and I talked to Jessica a couple times. I adore her. She is so down to earth and fun.
Yeah.
I love her to pieces. And that's her favorite movie as well that her dad did is
Deception.
Devotion. Yeah. Devotion was the one about the Bronte sisters, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
So your father wanted to be a swashbuckler.
Yeah. Everything. He was a thoroughly trained actor. He had been in a theater academy at the conservatory. prior to him even going with Max Reinhardt. So he knew how to do, he was trained to do everything.
If fencing,
it was,
yeah.
Or horseback riding or singing or dancing or whatever it was. He was trained to do it all. And that was part of his joy of being an actor, was to spread his wings, to stretch himself, to see how far could he take a character or a characterization, and always finding the, you know, the truth and who that character was. So that was very important to him. He really wasn't interested in being caught up in a cliche, you know, in a pigeonholed in a specific type of role, which is also why he said yes to playing a couple of the Nazi roles that he ended up playing, because he, having experienced that time, and both in Vienna and in Berlin and in London, he knew that they were not just heavy-handed thugs. They were very educated, charming men, and it was and women. So for him, he could see that people would get caught up in being in their company, because they were capable of. It was a seduction. You know, it wasn't just you will do this, but it was a, you know, there was a slinky, slimy, but charming way that they moved about. So he was willing to do that because he wanted to show that side of those characters.
Yeah, it's well, he was not typecast, that's for sure, because he broke the mold after doing that. Like you said, he wanted to do the other things. He was never typecast in any role. From what I'm looking at all of his work he's done. He worked with Katharine Hepburn, and he liked her a lot, right?
Yes. Again, true, dedicated professionals always caught his attention.
I'm sure there are ones that weren't, that he didn't like too much either. You can trust me. You could tell me mine. ones he didn't like. I'm sure there are ones he didn't like, too, because they were not professional and whatever. But you don't have to tell me. We'll just
There were definitely those that he didn't care for, both professionally and personally, that he worked with. And then you have people like Kate, who he did like to work with and did enjoy as a person. And the same with Betty, who he liked very much, both professionally and personally. And never to leave out my mother, because, again, it was always the three of them together in the living room until the wee hours, talking about life and love and family and children and all the rest of that goes along with that. They were great friends.
Katharine is great friends, and Betty was great friends with your dad.
Yeah, Betty, definitely. Kate, I don't remember being in the house all that much, because that was a whole other thing. But they appreciated each other professionally and enjoyed each other's company, yes. But Betty was often at our house, and we were often at hers.
Did you guys live on that bus line of the Hollywood tours? Do you know how they take the tourists would go to see the houses of the stars?
Yes.
You did? Wasn't that weird?
Yes.
You're growing up and these people are gaping at your house every day, three times a day or something.
It was even more ridiculous when I do remember a day, I think I was in my early teens, and my father and I were either just leaving or just coming back, and we had a big gate that you had to open to get onto the property, and that you couldn't see through, a big solid wooden gate, and the bus had pulled up behind us, and my father was trying to rather quickly I don't know, whatever it was, and the bus driver yelled at him, he said, "Oh, is Mr. Henry home?"
Oh, they didn't even know who he was.
No, my father said, "No. No, he's not here."
That's so creepy. And it's so stupid they didn't even know who he was. But, I mean, all the time, people just gaping, yeah. Gaping. Did you know? Where'd you live?
We lived in a very, I guess, celebrity-dense neighborhood. So these drivers were, I think, amused by it all. Dori Sherry, who was the head of MGM, lived around the corner. Arthur Rubinstein lived at the top of the street. Pat O'Brien, Betty Hutton, Judy Garland.
Wow.
Fred Murray, Rita Hayworth. There were a bunch.
What a life. So you, I have to ask you, was your dad strict with you as a child? I know you had a sister Mimi as well. Was he a strict dad?
I don't really... He set certain standards And we were expected to live up to them. Let me put it that way. I'm not really sure what strict means in that respect. You know, I mean, I think if you look at the, you know, if you want to compare him to Mommy Dearest, no. But yes, we had to behave in a certain way, and we had to dress in a certain way, and there were rules, and there were expectations, and we had to live up to them. Yeah, definitely.
Did you?
And that was old. That was sort of the older, sort of aristocratic patterns that he had come from, old world rules, so to speak.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Christina Crawford? I know Jessica met her once. Did you? And she met Joan.
It's funny. I don't actually remember 100%, but I do remember going to Joan Crawford's apartment in New York as a child, because we were indeed the children, and my sister and I were supposed to have a play date. And I don't remember the kids at all.
They're the twins.
Polite of me at all. What I remember was stepping into the apartment, not being allowed off the foyer level. So there were nannies. It's not to say we were alone ever, but there was sort of a step down, and you could see into the living room, and everything was covered in plastic.
Oh my God.
Made to order fitted plastic.
Oh my God. Well, at least she had designer plastic. Thank God.
It was horrible. The opposite of the way we were in our house. We had a big house, but it was open and comfortable, and nobody ever felt really ill at ease other than, you know, being in awe of my father. I mean, you could come in, you could sit down on any chair. There was open French doors to the front porch that overlooked the rose garden to the side, which overlooked the swimming pool. I mean, it was easy. It was comfortable.
Plastic. Funny. Plastic.
Yeah, it
was your stuff.
There was nothing plastic about my upbringing at all.
Yeah.
None.
Well, well, let's talk about what happened to your dad when he got, there was the Hollywood 10, and your dad went with a bunch of other actors and actresses, with Lauren Bacall, Humphrey Bogart, Danny Kaye. They went to Washington. Your father stood heads and tails above them all. He was so tall. The other ones look so short. And that got him into some trouble. This was a horrible time. This was just a horrible time. Blacklisting, communism. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, that was the Committee for the First Amendment, who, as you say, flew to Washington to support the writers and the people who were then being accused of being communists in Hollywood, et cetera, and so forth. He never actually made a court appearance or anything like that, but they were all there in support of it. And then it unraveled. It started falling apart because some of the people who were, and I put the word accused in quotes, who were accused of being communist actually did believe in the communist system, which of course was a gigantic no-no at that time. And just, you know, guilt by association. And he couldn't understand why he would be blacklisted because he wasn't a communist, even though he knew a lot of these people, because he's in Hollywood, you work with each other, you know, the writers and directors and actors all work together. So anyway, he never thought that he would be blacklisted. And he came back to Hollywood and found out that all of the studios, all of the major studios had blacklisted him. So he could not work in Hollywood with any of the majors for 5 years.
Wow. Well, what about the others? I know that I was talking to a Hollywood historian, and he said, why wasn't Humphrey Bogart blacklisted? Because he went there, and the others were blacklisted, and he said that Bogart kind of stepped back from
He stepped back, and he wrote a letter, and he put it in, they interviewed him and put it in magazines that he didn't know, and he didn't know that these people actually were complicated times.
Yeah.
You know, very complicated times. Yeah. But he, to be honest, he was an American.
Mm.
And my father wasn't.
True. So true.
He had become an American citizen by then, yes, but he wasn't considered an American. know.
So I don't think very many were. I know a lot of writers were and directors. And what I really hated was when I read about the people who testified against people they worked with and all the, you know, it was just like, I don't understand you guys. How could you do that to me? Yeah. How creepy. You're ruining someone's career and life.
Yeah, horrible and really just despicable times.
Yes. And so he was blacklisted from the studios for 5 years. Yes. And then he started acting again.
But he kept working. He didn't stop working. And again, had this not happened to him, then the next step of his career wouldn't have happened. He was then offered to do independent filmmakers, both in America and in Europe, most specifically England, offered him these other films and to keep going. And because of his own integrity and his own philosophy about, pursuing your career and being responsible for your family and so on and so forth, he took these other films and again learned a lot about independent filmmaking. And there was a company that was forming in the States, and they came to him and said, look, we can't give you your full salary. We're going to give you maybe half your salary and then let you be, we'll call you a producer. And then if the film makes money, you'll get a certain percentage of it. And by then he knew enough about, the accounting and how all that stuff works. And he said, okay, I'll do that. It ended up those three, maybe four films, he made more money making those than he did on either Casablanca or Now Voyager.
Wow.
Possibly Now Voyager and Casablanca combined, he made more than that. And so again, it was a learning process. He was involved from the beginning. And out of that come films like Hollow Triumph. And actually, I think Hollow Triumph came before that. And
Some noir stuff. He did some noir, yeah.
It's being in the right place at the right time and the wrong place at the wrong time and learning how to ride with the wave, so to speak. And again, thank goodness, his luck was that my mother was there right next to him. She would never, ever let him give up. She always encouraged him. She always told him it would get better or it would get back to normal. She always was the one to stand there and say, come on, let's be smart about this. Let's move ahead. Let's make a good. And it was always we. It was never I or you.
They were a team.
They were a real team. Well, luckily, she had in her career also, there were times when she was making the money and holding him up. And
right.
Once she came to California, she just decided for the most part she wanted just to be, a mom and run the house and so on and so forth. And again, very luckily, she had phenomenal taste and people adored her. I still run into kids Once we were into the 1950s and my father was doing all these independent things, she started dance classes, cotillions, like they have in Europe, that she had gone to as a child.
They wear the white gloves.
You wear the white gloves.
Yeah.
They're very cool. You don't just learn how to dance. You learn good manners and you learn how to interact with the opposite sex and so on and so forth. And it was a very interesting thing that she chose to do. And so she was making money doing that also because it was teaching cotillions and trophy balls, and all the celebrities would come because all the kids of the celebrities were part of it. And so, I mean, it was them shifting back and forth, figuring out how to make things work.
But how lucky did they were so much of a team. Did you and your sister ever feel left out, or was it more, do you know what I mean? Sometimes people think that their parents are, as an example, and I'm not saying anything like your mother and father were like them, because I'm sure they weren't, Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan, their kids felt left out because they were so much of a team that they felt that their parents weren't as much into them as they were just concentrating on that team.
Well, I can't obviously speak for my sister, but I can tell you for me, I never felt left out. They were very supportive of anything we did. My sister was a great athlete. And we would go to all of her tournaments and all of her events.
She was a tennis pro, right?
That's right. And she was a national junior champion. And we went to all sorts of tennis events and tennis tournaments. We spent summers on tour with her. It was great. I mean, we went, our family holiday became this wonderful tour of tennis tournaments. So, and for me, you know, we would go to the opening of the Ice Capades and the Ice Follies and the opera and so on. And lucky for me, there was a point where my mother just was exhausted and didn't want to go to any more premieres and things like that. So I became, when I was about 12, I started to sort of become my father's date.
Fun. Now, you must have had so much fun.
I got to go to all the premieres with him and again, you know, all the sporting events and so on. So it was absolutely wonderful because I love the arts. I love the ballet. I love concerts and opera and so on and so forth. So no, I don't think we were left out. I certainly never felt left out, but again, I can't answer for my sister.
But I think that's good. You know, that you were a nice family unit. They were supportive of you and all that. Who was your
dinner was a family deal. 7 o'clock, you were clean. You were in clean clothes. You showed up at dinner and you had the dinner conversations, and the food was always spectacular. So it was a nice thing to be able to do. The only times that we didn't all eat together was if my father was late at the studio from the studio or if he was out of town on location. But the rest of the time, dinner was all of us together.
That's very important. People don't do that anymore. That's a shame. I love the whole dinner bit, the proper dinner. And It's so much fun, and it's nice, and it's good for everybody. You reconnect, talk about your day, do all that stuff. So when you went on, you went with your dad on all these things. Who was your favorite celebs?
Oh, I did. I don't know. I love Betty because she was there. That was sort of a hands-on relationship. I literally knew her well my whole life. I mean, when I was starting my career, she was very supportive of me, and when I had moved to New York, she was in New York, and you know she was just a great friend. She was like extended family, you know. So certainly Betty is the top of that list. I don't know, I'm not very
celeb conscious.
Yeah, I know, for me, because I've been there too. I mean, it's a job.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there are some people that I would be inclined to admire more than actors.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because Jessica said, it's like, you know, I didn't care. They're just people I grew up with every day, you know, and are seen. And it was like no big deal to me.
Exactly. Exactly. They were our Smiths and Joneses. They were our neighbors. They were the people or the cup of sugar from, you know. It was no big deal about it at all. And at one point or another, there were a lot of celebrities who were at our house that they would come over the weekend by the pool and you know, whatever. I never really paid attention that they were celebrities. They were either nice or they weren't.
Yeah, they were just either creepy people or nice people.
You know, that's it. Yeah.
So then your dad became a director, Mr. Multifaceted Dude. Yes. And he did Dead Ringers. I'm kidding. He did Dead Ringer, which is such, when I saw that he directed this was years ago. And I, you know, I look it up on IMDb, and years ago I saw that you were his daughter. And I found that movie, and like I said, sometimes I can't watch it. I'll start watching it, and it's like the music was amazing because it brings that tension, that jazz, that non-ending
Andre
jazz.
Huh? You know, Andre Previn, you can't beat it. You
it
know,
was unbelievable because
it was great.
It brought the tension. And me, I'm like, I can't take any more of the same jazz song, but it was perfect. And then they did like this creepy music. I loved it. What was it like working with your dad and Betty? And there's I put a picture on my Facebook page of you and your dad's wearing his glasses and during the movie. So you're looking at the script and you were probably asking him some stuff.
Right.
How was that?
That's on his Facebook page too. We have an official Facebook page for him as well. Well, all the rest of them, Instagram and Twitter and all that. So yes, I know exactly what picture you're talking about.
I love that picture. It's very cute.
Thank you.
So
it was great working with him. And that wasn't the first time. And again, here we go with the myths of it all. I have a lot of press clippings that say that was my first film. It wasn't my first film. They say it was the first time working with my father. It wasn't the first time working with my father. So, you know, I grew up, luckily, he and I got along very well when we got along very well. And we argued pretty well, too. We argued pretty fair. We were pretty good at it. And it was great working with him because he is, you know, the consummate professional. He knows exactly what he wants out of his actors. He knows exactly what he wants out of his cameraman. He's well rehearsed. I mean, I remember so many evenings when I would have liked a little help with my homework that he was actually in his office with the doors closed doing his homework. He was planning whatever was going to be the next day, whatever was being on, you know, shot the next day, whatever scenes would be. If I was in it or not, that's irrelevant. It's when he was directing television. It was great. It was great working with him. It was great working with her. It's always good when you work with professionals. I had the opportunity to work with people who were
not. Were you in Girls on the Loose or Live Fast, Die Young? I know that was one of those movies you're in, right?
Yeah. That was so long ago. Thanks for bringing that up.
Well, I'm just trying to prove your point that you did a movie before Dead Ringer.
Yeah.
Ringer. Yeah.
Yes, I did. And then there was some television in between.
Oh, you were in The Terror in Teakwood, right?
Yes, I was.
I'm trying to think because I've watched all the thrillers. And I can't remember which one that is. I'm going to watch it later because I can find it on YouTube.
Because that's where one pianist is jealous of another dead pianist's hand.
Oh, my goodness. I love that one.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one.
Oh, I'll watch it. I'm going to watch that tonight. You were also, you did like a 70s TV movie, didn't you? You do those kind of things as well. And with your dad, I can't believe how often he directed Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
29 episodes.
Amazing. Did he know Hitchcock and were they pals? Or, you know, he must have respected your dad to have him do 28 episodes. That's amazing.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, they knew each other. Were they pals? I don't think pals is applicable to Hitch, but... yeah, they definitely knew each other, and they did know each other socially as well. But again, there is a tremendous respect back and forth between two professionals.
Yeah, and you know, to do that, I'm just looking at all this in my notes. I can't get over all, you taught me so much stuff, and it's so funny, because like you said, this documentary has to be out there because you. You dispel myths. You're putting out the truth. I saw on YouTube, you can catch some of the trailers. Monica is narrating. You have a great voice to narrate this thing.
Oh, thank you. That's sweet of you.
It really is. And then some other guy was narrating, and I said, where's Monica? I don't like his, no offense, other guy, but I didn't like his voice. I said, I want Monica to narrate. I don't like this guy. So
we have to do that for the documentary because I don't think you can sit for an hour and a half and just listen to me, you know.
But it's not really that because you're showing clips and things like that.
I appreciate the compliment. However, I think there are, yes, we're showing clips, and yes, we have fabulous interviews. I mean, just absolutely fabulous interviews with people who work with him, all of whom have different relationships. So they all have different stories to tell, which was just great. And I didn't realize until I really got 10 of them, the primos that I really wanted, that three of the people who were willing to be interviewed for this are Kennedy Honors recipients. That blew me away.
Big honor. Who?
That's huge. That's huge. It was Norman Lear, Norman Lear, Zubin Mehta, and Rita Moreno.
Oh, yeah. She was in that. Yeah. I thought your father directed that movie. Rita, wasn't that her first film she did with your dad? She was in that movie.
That was the first one where she had a principal part, yes. Indeed.
She was very good. And he played like a guy who came in to reform this girls' reform school.
Correct.
I love that movie. And they had so many people. I think Ann Jackson was in it. Ann Francis, who was hot. Yep. What a babe.
And again, this was one of those moments where, because it wasn't a studio film, he had the opportunity to have more involvement because he was king of the hill. I mean, he was the star. And they asked, you know, his opinion, and he sat in on the casting, and he literally handpicked those three ladies.
Well, they were pretty darn good, and I enjoyed it very much. One of your father's performances I just saw, well, just, I'll say, 3 months ago, 10,000 Bedrooms, and he played Anton, and he was a very humorous character. I thought he was adorable and funny, and he was like a bad artist, and he was just so good. I loved him.
Just like so many people didn't realize how physical he was, what a good athlete he was. Yeah. They don't realize how funny he was. He had a great sense of humor.
I think
Wicked, actually.
I love Wicked sense of humor. I think a lot of people have the misconception that your dad was very serious, no fun. Because he wasn't Mr. Big publicity dude, you know?
He was Victor and he was Jerry. He was heroic and he was romantic. And that's it. And both of those roles are very serious roles. Both of those films, the characters he plays in those two films are very serious.
Big time, especially people. especially in Casablanca as the Nazi freedom fighter.
But he, the person, was very funny. He had a great sense of humor. He loved tricksters. Like Charlie Chaplin was a friend.
Yeah.
And go and visit with them in Switzerland and so on and so forth. And Charlie had a tennis court, and Charlie didn't like the pro, who we thought was arrogant and obnoxious, which I think is hilarious coming from him. Completely something else.
Yeah.
So he and my father got together and decided to, because again, at the time, my sister was junior national champion here in the States and tiny. I mean, she's just this little tiny girl. And so Charlie decided what he was going to do. He was going to invite the tennis pro to come up to the house and then challenge him to this match. And obviously the tennis pro would pick my father as his partner.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie and my sister beat the pants off this tennis pro.
Good for
them. Which made Charlie and my father very happy. Sorry, you know.
I know. I read this funny quote about Charlie Chaplin. They said, if people aren't sitting at his feet, he'll find where people are sitting and stand in front of them. So true. And I'm reading a book. I'm going to interview a guy who wrote a bio on Charlie Chaplin. So I'm reading that, and I'll have him on because he's such a character.
But fascinating. Again, fascinating.
Yes, totally.
After dinner, we go into the living room and the girls would probably play guitar or piano or something, and we'd sit around and talk. And then before the children, would be in a different room or go out on the porch, and the grown-ups would stay in the main living room. So, I mean, he was fascinating, such a raconteur, such an amazing charm he had about him.
Why did he get kicked out of the States? Was that the blacklist as well, or...?
Well, it was sort of his version. It was again, communist leanings vis-a-vis fighting. He didn't want to pay, or he didn't pay taxes or something. When all of this was going on, I was a child.
Yes.
I wasn't even a teenager. I was a child. So a lot of these stories come after the fact to me.
Right.
A lot of these were conversations around the dinner table when I was growing up later. You know, and I did, luckily, even as an adult, stay close with my parents. So I did get to, you know, hear some pretty good stuff.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you stayed friends with your parents because I do a lot of, and Jessica, she was with her dad. Her ex-husband was on and he was good, but... Jessica, I just love her. And now I love you, Monica. I think you're great.
Oh, thank you.
I do too. I love you. Are you going to go to Has it happened yet, the thing down in Florida? Are you going to go to Key West again or Key Largo or wherever you guys go?
Yes. Well, it was the Humphrey Bogart Film Festival,
right.
But we didn't go last year. They canceled it or postponed it. Maybe it'll happen this year. I don't know. I haven't heard.
Did you like Stephen? I heard he's a character.
Bogart?
Stephen Bogart, yeah.
One of a kind. He's fabulous.
That's what he seems to me. I saw him, Eddie Mueller, interview him, and I loved him. And, you know, he's got his mom's eyes. They say he looks so much like Bogey, but he's got those beautiful Lauren Bacall eyes.
Yeah.
Don't you think? You're right up next to him.
Yeah, I don't see her in him because I don't pay attention to celebrities or movie stars or whatever have you, like fans do.
Ho-hum, next.
Well, no. Yeah.
Okay, Monica, so are you still shooting this? And when are we going to be, what about this documentary? When are we going to be seeing this?
Well, I wish I had an actual answer for that, but being the rather typical, independent, underfunded documentary film, we struggle to make it from one section to another. We do have all the interviews on film. We do have 99.9% of anything else we want to shoot. We know what clips we want to use. We know we have all the interviews. We have, like I just said, that. It's basically in post-production. I've been working on it. The biggest thing is, excuse me, when you get to this point and you have accumulated so much information, I'm beginning to joke now because I used to say, okay, we'll make a 5-minute trailer to raise the money to make a 90-minute documentary. And now I feel that I need to raise the money to make a 90-minute documentary so that we can make a 6-part miniseries.
Yeah, because you have so much. You acquired so much.
There's so much information.
Tell people where they can help donate. I think you should have a distributor. Shame on, you know, you'd think TCM or something because it's a good one. I loved your TCM honoring your dad. I thought that was really great.
Thank you. Well, lest we get too far away from what you just said.
We won't.
I would say that we do have a website, which is Henried Beyond Laszlo. And once you get to the homepage of that, there's a tab that says participate. There's lots of stories. There's lots of pictures on the whole website, but excuse me, there is a tab that says participate. And when you go, we follow that, you click on that tab, it will take you to two ways to participate. One is just, you know, basically with your credit card through PayPal. The other is through a nonprofit organization called From the Heart. And if you go through them, a lot of people who want to give more, a lot of money. I love them. Thank you so much. they would like it as a tax deductible donation. They can go through the link that goes through to From the Heart and donate that way.
I'm going to link that up for you when I post this. And you also have a Paul Henry Facebook page. You're on Twitter. You're on.
Yes.
So just give me the, you can email me the Twitter and your Instagrams, what that is.
Okay.
And I'll link that as well. And a link where people can donate, because I think it's going to be a fabulous documentary. And like I said, I learned so much. I really did. And I'm reading. Like I said, I've been cramming to when I have you on to get to know things. And not everything is right. So I really love it. And I'm sure my listeners will love this. And they will appreciate knowing the facts, just the facts, ma'am, as well.
Just the facts, yeah. And again, everything, because people always respond or always refer to Casablanca first, that is specifically why this is called Paul Henried Beyond Victor Laszlo.
I love
that. It's really the story of his entire life, his entire career, and his contribution, because aside from Rita Moreno and Richard Dreyfuss and Anne Francis, he boosted and started the careers of so many up-and-coming and then award-winning actors. And it's fascinating because even though they don't tell the same stories, all these wonderful people who have participated in the film,
right,
that one thing they do have in common is how much they adored my father. And that is just
a wonderful tribute. What a tribute. Could you ask for anything better?
Exactly.
So send me an email about all your other stuff, and I will link you up. And Monica, you were so great. I want to thank you so much for coming on. And when this I'm going to donate, by the way. But I'm not one of those rich donors, but I'm going to do something. And
I appreciate everything wholeheartedly because, again, as we move through this, this type of documentary takes a very, very long time to make. It's a slow-moving project, but at the end, I think we'll all be happy that it was worth it.
I think so, from what I've seen and what I've heard and what I know about your dad and you. I just think it's going to be fab. So why don't you come back on when we get that documentary out there, and we'll toast each other with some champagne and say yay, or wine, or whatever.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. Thanks, Monica. I had such a nice time with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs are never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have its mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome.